stopped. UN sources are reporting a rebel offensive north of Goma, and the rebels are confirming that they have brushed back the army there. Also, reports have emerged that a militia believed to be in league with the army is now trying to pick off weapons from retreating soldiers. These developments are unfolding against a backdrop of human misery born of the fighting, as civilians remain caught, pillaged, and hungry in the crossfire. Gwen Tompkins, NPR News, Nairobi.
Two astronauts are scheduled to carry out a lengthy cleaning and lube job today in the first of several spacewalks outside the International Space Station. The astronauts will try to resurrect a massive joint that rotates one of the orbiting outpost's solar panel wings toward the sun. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
WILL programs are made possible by Pages for All Ages, books, music, cafe, and DVDs in Savoy. A locally owned independent bookstore, Pages' goal is to provide a full-service store with a comfortable setting for customers' enjoyment. In Savoy or on the web at www.pagesforallages.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayn, is at the controls this morning. Human beings have been fascinated by dolphins for a very long time. Dolphins figure in the mythology of the ancient Mediterranean and also in Hindu mythology. In modern times, scientists have studied dolphins and have studied them often, though, in marine aquariums, essentially, on land, or they have studied them from boats. The actual details of how dolphins live in the sea have often been hard to come by. This morning, however, we'll be talking with two scientists who have spent quite a lot of time between them studying dolphins beneath the ocean's surface, Drs. Kathleen Dudzinski and Tony Frohoff. They are the authors of a recently published book. The title is Dolphin Mysteries, Unlocking the Secrets of Communication. It's published by the Yale University Press and particularly looks at how dolphins live and communicate and interact with one another, and also how dolphins interact with other species, including human beings. One of the things that they say that they have learned is that dolphins are not just members of a group, that they are unique individuals. And they're joining us this morning by telephone. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guests. Kathleen Dudzinski is a scientist. She's an educator. She's also the director of the Dolphin Communication Project. Her work has been featured in the IMAX movie Dolphins. She's authored many scientific and popular articles on dolphins and other marine animals, as well as a children's book. She's also been inducted into the Women Divers Hall of Fame. She makes her home in Connecticut. Tony Frohoff is a scientist and writer. She's the director of Terramar Research and research director of the Whale Stewardship Project. She's the co-editor of Between Species, Celebrating the Dolphin-Human Bond. She's written for the New York Times. Her work has been featured in documentaries and also television shows, including 2020, National Geographic Explorer, A&E, Good Morning America, and others. She makes her home in Seattle, Washington, so they live on opposite ends of the continent. They're joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people are welcome to call with questions. We just ask callers to try and be brief so we can get in as many as we can, but of course, anyone's welcome to call. Well, Dr. Dudzinski, hello.
Good morning.
And Dr. Frohoff.
Good morning.
Thank you both very much for being with us. And I just want to make sure, is it true that you guys are each both where you live? That Dr. Dudzinski, you're in Connecticut, and Dr. Frohoff, you're in Seattle?
Yes. I'm looking over the Puget Sound right now.
Okay, good. Well, are you if you're both inside of water, I guess that's probably a good thing. Just to start out, I guess I am interested in the fact that human beings have been interested in dolphins for a very long time, and probably thousands of years, I guess, at least, as I said, going back to the Greeks and to the and it goes back in Hindu mythology. Why, I wonder, do you think that these animals have so captured human imagination for such a long time.
Well, I don't think we really know. I think it's a personal thing for all people that I've met anyway. There's a variety of different reasons that I've heard. For me, I'm fascinated by their social behavior and their communication.
And I would say, add to that, that, you know, dolphins are rare among wild animals in that it is not uncommon for them to approach people and initiate friendly contact with them. And so I find this, you know, to be an incredible opportunity for study, as well as, you pointed out, looking at how the cultures of dolphins intermingle with the cultures of different people around the world.
Well, that, I think you put your finger on something probably that is important and does indeed set these animals apart from others as far as wild animals are concerned, and that is that they seem to be interested in people or interesting to, and of course people are interested in them. There seems to be here a particular case where maybe more than with the case with other wild animals, we have two members of two species who seem to be interested in each other enough so that they don't, at least the wild animals don't seem always to show the natural sort of fear that a lot of other wild animals were, where when they would see a human being, their first inclination would be to turn around and go the other way, not to go over and try and say hello or see what's going on or see what they are.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that we like to point out in the book is that it's not just what they are. We're finding out in incremental degrees who they are as members of a group as well as individuals. And when they come to interact with us, which I must say is not all the time, but when we do have these occasions, we get a rare glimpse into what it might be like for dolphins to communicate with one another, even though we are poorly suited to communicate like a dolphin physiologically. But I should take the opportunity to point out as well that not all dolphins want to interact with people, and so I hope that we don't encourage, I think we both want to be very responsible in saying, you know, we don't want to urge people to go out en masse and try to interact with every dolphin they see, because dolphins certainly have their own lives, and as Kathleen has pointed out so well, they are very busy in their own social networks and trying to stay alive out in the wild. Mm.
One of the points that you make here early on in the book is that the kind of study that you have tried to do, where you're trying to observe and perhaps interact with the animals in open water, is different, and by actually getting into the water, is different from what people have done, either tried to do from boats or have done where you have animals essentially in captivity, where they may be in some kind of a large aquarium where they keep animals for study for this. How is that really different? Does it give you a view that you otherwise would not have?
Well, by placing our perspective or our observation platform underwater, observing these animals where they reside, first we have to be able to see them, and that's pretty much, we have to study them in tropical waters or waters that are clear enough to be seen. And to have, as Tony pointed out earlier, a group of individuals that are habituated to us underwater that would allow us to watch what they're doing, hopefully being as non-invasive as possible without trying to have them pay attention to us, just actually watching what they're doing. It actually gives us a much, much wider field of view just underwater because we can look at individual interactions.
Well, I think that you I'm sure you put your finger on here on what is a significant issue for any scientist, a human scientist who's trying to study a wild animal in the wild, and that is their presence there changes the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suppose you have to ask yourself, are these animals, because if these animals are aware of me, is their behavior different now than it would be if I was not here? And so am I truly seeing their natural behavior, or is their behavior in some way, it might be a small way, but you would have to say, is their behavior in some way being influenced by my presence?
But how would we know what their behavior is without the presence of human beings? So it's kind of a catch-22 for
yeah.
us, because no matter if we're going to observe these animals in the wild, the only way for us to actually observe them without interacting with them would be from land, from a land vantage point.
Anytime we're from a boat or underwater, we're there. And so to get that close-up view, no matter what, we're there, but we can try to be as non-invasive as possible and then also account for what might be behaviors that might be a response to us. I don't know if you'd have anything to add to that, Tony.
Well, I think that, David, you raise a very good question and one that Kathleen and I and many of our other researcher friends have had to deal with for years, including those who don't deal with, you know, who don't study dolphins. I mean, we refer to the work of Jane Goodall, which was pivotal. You know, you can only put up a blind for so long, and to do that underwater where you've got currents and where dolphins are constantly moving is virtually impossible most of the time. So, yes, I mean, in some cases, I try to be as what I call boring as possible underwater so that if the dolphins do see me, you know, they can recognize me over time. And that's pretty evident. And that if there's a certain social group we're studying, then I will just try to be there with my video camera and not interact with them, even though my personal inclination would be to do otherwise. I would really try to be boring, and that's what I train my interns to do, to try not to interact with them if I need to study them to see who they are without our presence as much as possible. But yes, it's always a factor.
This is a question that I know is completely speculative, but if you are interacting with some animals and maybe, I suppose it's not possible to know had they had any experience or much experience or contact with humans. But the question is, what do you think, obviously they know you're not dolphins, but then the question would be, what do they think that you are? Is that a question that's possible to answer, or is that even a question that's worth thinking about?
I don't think I've ever thought about what they think of me, except in hoping that they pay no attention to me. I believe that Tony and I are probably two of the only people that really want dolphins to ignore us. to just go about their business and let us watch, you know, what's going on and see what they're doing. And I guess I would have to say that yours for me is a unique question because I've never really tried to delve into what they might think of me, except hoping that I'm, you know, not irritating them.
Right, and I agree, and sometimes I deal with situations where we really are interacting with solitary dolphins. And Kathleen and I worked with one dolphin in Brazil named Pita, who was, we call them solitary yet sociable because they are rarely, if ever, seen in the company of other dolphins, but they will try to interact with people. And so what I have come to somewhat specialize in is working with solitary dolphins and beluga whales and, to a lesser degree, orcas in the wild. And we don't know if this is somewhat of an artifact of, you know, the habitat degradation or whatnot, but we're finding orphaned beluga whales and orcas for the first time who pop up, and they might be nutritionally weaned, but they have not been socially weaned, and they're by themselves when they're normally extremely social. And so, you know, I'll come into a situation like that, and it's very much a challenge, David, because, you know, people will say, well, what do we do? How do we not make that? We don't want to tame the animal, but at the same time, we want to recognize that these animals have, you know, rich psychological needs and complex needs. And so in some ways, do people need to become surrogate pods for them if they're never going to reunite with members of their own kind? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm explaining it. So it's constant challenge and question.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about the possibility of a situation where either you, in this interest of trying to understand the dolphin communication, whether you might make an attempt to communicate with them or they might make some attempt to communicate with you, perhaps just to see what would happen. I guess I'm just the curious about this idea about, well, how we know what they are, but whether you could even entertain the notion that they would be thinking about who we are or what we are.
Well, I think they probably have their own thoughts and ideas of what we are in varying different interactions. There are several people I don't have a full count on it yet, but there are numerous people out there who actually communicate with dolphins on a daily basis, and those are trainers in some of these marine parks that work with dolphins on a daily basis. So there likely is communication going on between individuals, and in the wild, I'm sure that there is communication that has gone on between different individuals. Across species and within species, and I tend to focus on dolphin-to-dolphin communication to try to observe the signals they exchange to get an idea of what is etiquette in the dolphin world, you know, how do they exchange information, what is their social norm. But Tony has focused on human-dolphin communication, and I've seen some of the communication. I've seen interactions where dolphins will mimic human behavior, which I believe is a form of communication. We may not necessarily know what the messages are that are exchanged, but I'm sure the communication is going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, very quickly here, just let me introduce the two of you for people who might have tuned in. We're talking here this morning with Drs. Kathleen Dudzinski and Tony Frohoff. Kathleen Dudzinski is a scientist, educator, director of the Dolphin Communication Project. Tony Frohoff is also a scientist and writer. She's director of Terramar Research and research director of the Whale Stewardship Project. And together, they are the authors of the book Dolphin Mysteries, Unlocking the Secrets of Communication. It is published by the Yale University Press and takes account of explains some of the research that they have been involved in studying dolphins and their behavior in the open water. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that for people, when we talk about communication, the first thing that we think of is verbal communication, and I'm sure people would say, well, and there are all sorts of other kind of communications that human beings use, verbal and nonverbal. There are all sorts of things that go into that. So that's our sort of our first model, I guess. When you think about communication in dolphins, however, what is it that we're talking about, and what sort of behaviors really are we talking about that constitute communication?
Well, I think it's similar to what you just described. There are vocal signals that are thought about for communication among dolphins. They're whistles and clicks. You may be hearing the beagle barking in the background here. I apologize for that. That's another form of communication. but there's a variety of other signals as well. And using the dog as an example, they have a play bow that is used to indicate that they want to play, which is their front portion of their body goes down and their butt's in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure that any listeners will think, you know, of their parents or their spouses and know that they can exchange a glance with these individuals and know exactly what they're thinking without having to exchange words. And I'm sure that it's something similar for dolphins. I don't know if you'd want to add anything, Tony.
Well, I think in that vein, you know, we've tried to come up in this book with what may be one of the first dolphin dictionaries of some sort, and it's really, of course, at this point of research, very rudimentary because we've only begun to study these marine mammals for a few decades, as opposed to because it's harder to study them underwater than it is to study terrestrial animals, or at least it has been in the past. And yes, there are such a wide and rich variety of communication signals that are exchanged. In fact, one of the things that Kathleen writes about is how the pectoral fins often rub together so frequently, and we all see that. And that can be equated with holding hands, reassuring pats on the back, things like that, even reprimands, and there are all forms of style. So we think because dolphins don't have hands in the way that we do, that perhaps they don't engage in as much social physical contact with one another. But when you study them underwater in the wild, especially, I found that it's just surprising and incredibly wonderful. And it is a mystery. That's why the book is called Dolphin Mysteries. But we are trying to solve some of them.
Mm.
Because I've had this question in recent past, is when we use the term dictionary and we use the term vocabulary to refer to the different signals that dolphins use, we're not really equating them to specific human words in that sense. We're using dictionary and vocabulary a little bit metaphorically to talk about the complex and varied nature of gestures and postures and behaviors and sounds that they'll use.
Well, tell me another story about, tell me a story perhaps about when you, when you first saw some particular behavior and you were trying to you were there watching and you were trying to figure out, well, what really is going on here? Is it always obvious, or is there some cases where it takes repeated observation before you begin to sort of say to yourself, okay, I kind of think I understand what's going on here?
Well, I'll just say, you know, I don't know if it was one of the first, but something that we see quite a lot of is the open mouth. Can be an open mouth snap of sorts. And that's something that can have a variety of meanings, but it depends on the context. And sometimes an open mouth, you know, as we write about, will look somewhat like a dolphin laughing. Mm. You know, it's the stereotypical, you know, what I kind of call the, you know, just the smiley flipper dolphin shot. And however, sometimes those images, even though they evoke the feeling of, oh, this is a friendly, smiling, happy dolphin, it can actually be a photo of a dolphin or a video or in real life, a dolphin who is engaged in warning a human or another dolphin to stay away. It could be a threat. And so I think it's one of those things that we have to be very careful to not attribute what is a fixed facial feature, being the dolphin smile, as being a mode of communication.
I had something similar, although a bit behavioral, and that's if you've ever watched a pack of dogs or maybe even a bunch of kids on a playground, some of the actions they use could be used in fighting, and they could be used in play, and you need to watch a little bit more carefully to determine that, you know, the hits that you see might just be, you know, weird handshakes or pats on the backs versus, you know, real punches or fights. And it's something similar with dolphins. They'll use some of the same actions or some same behaviors in playtime as they will during fights, but some of the other modifying cues are a little bit different. For example, dolphins who are playing will have a lot of affectionate rubbing as well, a lot of what I call sort of wrestling around one another. They'll approach one another from oblique angles or from behind, whereas when they're fighting, there's none of that affectionate rubbing or play behavior, and there's none of the soft angles of approach. It's more hard, right angles or head-to-head approaches, and things are more, the feel is more serious, and it's really hard to use some of these subjective terms, but by watching over and over and over some of the interactions between these animals, you get more of a sense of what's going on between them.
Mm-hmm. You know, human beings go from place to place. They certainly have different languages. They have different ways of communicating. They have different gestures. There are things that mean one thing one place and mean something very different someplace else. If you study dolphins, particularly those who live, if this is possible, those who live in different places, do you find that there is actually something like dolphin culture that differs from group to group, or is that behavior fairly uniform so that one dolphin from one place, if you got them together with the dolphin or a group of dolphins from another place, they would be able to communicate because they would essentially be using the same calls, the same gestures, the same kind of behaviors, and it would mean the same thing to everybody?
Well, dolphins from different areas that reside together, especially at different dolphin area, are able to communicate with one another. That said, that we're learning now that dolphins do show culture, and there are cultural differences depending on the groups that you study. And the fact that different individuals may have different cultural traditions doesn't necessarily preclude the fact that they might be able to communicate with one another. They just might not interact with one another to be able to communicate. Would they understand some of the similar gestures if they were taken from their different groups and put together? I believe they'd be able to communicate, but maybe they'd have to learn some of the other signals that they have between individuals. And we're just learning from a variety of different groups that some of the different cultural aspects are either passed down generation to generation or passed between individuals within a particular group. And there are several examples. Looking at foraging behavior of different dolphins, especially, for example, bottlenose dolphins, they have a variety of different methods, whether they're found on the east coast of the U.S., in the Gulf of Mexico, in Australia, in Japan. And so there are differences, but are they differences that would preclude communication? I'm not so sure there.
Hmm. Where I live, David, in the Pacific Northwest, we have the resident, what we call the resident orcas or killer whales, as some people call them, and they have been studied so extensively that literally they have found that the different groups have what we might call different accents, such as those you might find in different people across the U.S. And so apparently they do get together and socialize and mingle, perhaps such as, we could have Bostonians interacting with people from Texas and, Southern California. And so that's how some people see it, because there does seem to be communication going on. But literally some researchers who focus on this can, with their ear alone, tell an orca, tell which pod an orca is from, simply from the dialect, or what we might call their accents. Conversely, it could be that some have different languages almost completely, like we have different languages around the world. But there do seem to be common denominators of non-vocal communication as well.
Hmm. Do you see? Have you seen? I'm also curious, as you've done your observation, when you've seen juveniles and adults together, whether you see in their interaction cases where it seems to be fairly obvious that there is learning going on, that in some way what the adult is doing is the adult is teaching the juvenile something about, okay, this is how we do things, and that it's actually something that you can recognize as such?
It has been documented for a few different dolphin groups, and I have actually seen that in the Bahamas, where I saw an adult female who seemed to be babysitting about four or five calves. I saw this in a couple of different times, but on one particular occasion, the calves seemed to be practicing their echolocation on a group of horse-eyed jacks, which were too big for them to eat. They seemed to be delighting in chasing them and messing up their schooling behavior. And at one point, one of the adult female that was with them went in and pulled one of the dolphins out and brought that dolphin to the surface and held it at the surface, which is sort of a disciplinary behavior. Then the female went in and chased the horse-eyed jacks, and then the calf went in and did the same behavior. And the behavior before discipline and the behavior after discipline for the calf, I saw no difference, but then I'm not a dolphin. But the dolphin didn't get reprimanded the second time or disciplined. And so it's only one observation that I had of that particular interaction, but I would think that the adult female was saying, no, you got it wrong the first time, this is how you do it. And the calf did it the right way in terms of using its echolocation. And I didn't have a direct hydrophone right in front of the dolphins when they were chasing the fish, but there was echolocation going on, and it seemed to me to be a teaching behavior.
We are just a tiny bit past the midpoint here of this part of Focus 580, and again, maybe I'll just quickly introduce our guests. Kathleen Dunzinski, she's a scientist and an educator. She's director of the Dolphin Communication Project. Her work has been featured in the IMAX movie Dolphins. She's written many scientific and popular articles on dolphins and marine mammals. She makes her home in Connecticut. Tony Frohoff is a scientist, writer. She's director of the Terramar Research and research director of Whale Stewardship Project. She's the co-editor of Between Species, Celebrating the Dolphin-Human Bond. She's written for the New York Times. Her work's been featured in documentaries and in TV shows, and she lives in Seattle, Washington. Together, they are the authors of the book Dolphin Mysteries, the subtitle Unlocking the Secrets of Communication, and it is published by the Yale University Press. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just as a general question, I wonder if you could talk about how dolphins are doing and whether various kinds of human activity has been problematic for dolphins and for their survival.
Well, the issue of conservation and of populations as well as protection of individuals is, I believe, of paramount concern, or at least should be to every dolphin researcher and anybody who cares about animals, because It is critical. I mean, as you know, there are global changes occurring on unprecedented levels, at least in our history. And so we're just learning how dolphins are dealing with that, as well as the contaminants in the ocean and the acoustic challenges they face just from boat traffic and vessel harassment, as in whale watching when it's not monitored properly. And, we've got all sorts of activities that are going on where people really have a great opportunity to contribute, because many populations as well as species are endangered or threatened or have already become extinct. And so we hope that in people learning more about dolphins, that will foster a greater appreciation and respect and perhaps responsibility on the part of people to contribute to their well-being.
What do you think about the opportunities that people have to swim with dolphins? You can see the obvious attraction of being able to do something like that, but I think, again, you have to wonder, well, what exactly is this experience like for the dolphins, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think you have good programs and you have programs that are not so good, and both Tony and I have had very different experiences when it comes to swim programs. Focusing more on the captive swim programs. I think that if you have a program that has a very strong education base and takes into account the animal's well-being, that you have, I'm not opposed to the programs. All of my research is collected as part of swim programs. We have people that join us in the field to learn about dolphins as well as learning about the research and the programs that we do and such. So, this is a topic, and I want Tony to be able to say something about it as well, but it's a topic that definitely we could sit and have a full hour chat about, if not longer.
Yes, it's such a complex topic, and as Kathleen said, we've had very different experiences. I have, to some degree, been hired by government and non-government agencies to inspect some of the world's worst dolphin swim with facilities, you know, where they have dolphins on public display and people pay to swim with them. And so I could share many horror stories. And I also could say that, you know, there are some facilities, you know, where that have, you know, there is a huge range in terms of the way people take care of the dolphins. I will say that people will often just believe what the facilities tell them. Every facility manager or trainer will say, we take wonderful care of our dolphins. What we don't know is really what they consider wonderful care. To some people, that's just keeping them alive for a few years, even though their life expectancy can be into their 50s, 60s, and 70s. But, so there is a range of what people, how they value dolphins. I have come to, after years of seeing them in the wild and in captivity, I've come to have a more naturalistic perspective in terms of I just really prefer to see dolphins when they're not disturbed, when they're not taken from their families, and when people can have opportunities through video shows such as yours, movies, documentaries, or going out into the wild to observe them in their natural environment. I think people get a much broader education and see the dolphins for not as objects to be exploited as much as integral aspects of their environment. With that said, Kathleen's done some wonderful work in the facility, so I think that, as I said, there's a huge continuum.
Mm-hmm. Well, if that was something that you really, really wanted to do, is there something that constitutes a kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval that you could look for somebody's certification that a facility, to the best that they could determine, it was taking good care of the animals?
I wish there was. I mean, I could say that people could contact me through our website, and perhaps, other people. I don't know if Kathleen's available for questions like that. We can at least share, perhaps, or I could, what I know of, at least different standards. I may not know all the facilities, but I might know of the fact that some countries have no regulations, no standards for their dolphin facilities, as opposed to others that have very good, or at least reasonably good standards.
Hmm.
We do have some information about a few of the programs that we're involved with as links on our website as well. And certainly people can write to us at the Dolphin Communication Project to ask our opinion or details on some of the facilities as well. I've received numerous emails over the years from people interested in interacting with dolphins. Mm-hmm.
What do you, I suppose this goes back to the initial question I asked about the appeal of dolphins. I guess in part I wonder what it is that people get out of that or what it is that they think they're going to get out of it.
I was just going to say, you know, that's such a wonderfully and a somewhat it's just a huge question. You know, there are all sorts of concepts such as ecotherapy now, you know, where people are really trying to use nature, utilize experiences in nature as part of feeling better in the world. I think we've distanced ourselves quite a bit from the natural world, and that's part of the reason why I personally prefer to see dolphins, you know, people see dolphins in the natural environment, because not only do they get the pleasure of seeing the dolphins, they can also see the, you know, get the pleasure of being part of the ecosystem, you know, whether it's swimming with them in the wild or just being on the boat. Because a lot of that is people want a break. Some people just want to be entertained, and I think those people are content with a more circus-like atmosphere of a captive swim program, or at least some of them, where the dolphins are performing tricks and the behaviors are not authentic when they're exhibited towards the to swimmer. So I think people want to be entertained. They want to be healed. You know, they want to have a mystical experience even, and some people, I think, really want to go back to that place where there is the myth of the boy riding the dolphin in Greek culture, you know, from antiquity, times of antiquity, and they want to recreate that. And sometimes it can happen, I mean, because dolphins are friendly, but again, we need to be careful because our projection of what we want from them, I think we want to always be careful that we're not taking from them when they're already suffering so much from the effects of our life on their environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller here, and someone I have to assume is listening on the Internet, because I'm told that they're calling from Seattle, Washington, on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm somewhat surprised about the middle ground that's trying to be found with Swim with Dolphin programs. You know, we've got issues of care and variations in facilities, but aren't such facilities teaching the public, and children in particular, that captivity and unnatural behavior that's induced by humans for profit is the message we're spreading? And you know, I find that hard to accept. And when you add that to the fact that there are a lot of countries that don't have the infrastructure to regulate these types of activities and businesses, that we're just encouraging bad behavior by humans.
Well,
what's the question?
The question is why be so reluctant to say that captivity is wrong, that keeping dolphins confined against their will and training them in behaviors that go against their natural instincts.
Well, I guess I'll reply first. I'm not against captivity. I don't think it's wrong. I think, and this is again another topic for a very long period. I'll try to get my answer brief. But I actually study captive dolphins as well as wild dolphins, and I have not found any differences in the behavior that I see among the dolphins in a captive facility and the dolphins in the wild that I study, of the groups that I study. Everything that I've seen in one place, I've seen in the other area. And from what I've looked into for numbers, more animals that are in captivity now have been born there as opposed to having been collected and brought in from the wild. I'm not in favor of bringing animals in from the wild anymore, but we're learning a lot about the animals that are in human care that are being well taken care of. There's a lot of different reasons of things, what I've seen over the years in terms of why I support these programs. And when I'm actually doing data collection and analysis of the data that I have using comparison between the wild and captive dolphins, and I am finding significantly more similarity in their behaviors than differences. And the number of people that will actually be introduced to dolphins or observe dolphins in the wild is not as great as the number of people that will actually observe these animals in an up-close and personal way at these facilities. And that, in my mind, is a very strong program when it's very strong educational to foster conservation and environmental stewardship in the younger generations.
Without seeing your data, it's hard to, you know, take issue with everything you say, but in general, it's hard to believe that such drastic changes in these captive versus the wild dolphins, such drastic differences in their environment, it seems, if I understand you correctly, you're telling me that their behaviors are the same. And I find that hard to believe, and it goes counterintuitive. As far as dolphins in the wild, up close and personal, you know, what's the relationship when a dolphin pulls you around a pool? If that's up close and personal, that's a whole different understanding of a dolphin than you see spinner dolphins leaping into the air free, and they're giving a natural history explanation as part of a whale-watching expedition. And people understand that they're part of an integral to a whole ecosystem and not in this pent-in lagoon in which the interactions are far, far different. And so, you know, I just have a hard time accepting what you say at face value.
I thought, given that the caller's from Seattle, I might recognize the voice. I did send out an email letting people know that we're doing this show and the internet link. I don't, but recognize this person. But this perspective, it does reflect one that I've seen is to be very prominent in the Pacific Northwest, especially in that the people in Seattle and surrounding areas witnessed the capture of over 40 orcas just, you know, a few decades ago, more like the 60s and 70s. And they saw really incredible, brutal deaths and containment and harassment of the pods. And now as a result, the endangered population of resident orcas here may go extinct in large part due to being procured for captivity. So I think this caller reflects something that is a strong sentiment, at least in this part of the country, if not elsewhere, where captivity is just not considered appropriate for these animals anymore, given their, their intelligence and their emotional factors. If I can respond to one thing that, you know, I personally, again, I have that personally and professionally to some degree, I don't see captive swim programs as much more than petting pools, or not petting pools necessarily, but those are part of it, as much more than, people, what am I thinking of, Kathleen, where people go in and pet, you know, the barn animals at the
petting zoos.
Petting zoos, of course. I don't see much of a difference in many of the programs because most of the facilities that I've seen do not have a strong educational component, and even when they do, I don't know that there is a good educational message being imparted saying that you can, you know, take this animal and put it in what is often a concrete tank and just have people, you know, poke their hands on them and have the dolphin exhibit behaviors that are typically unnatural. I don't know, for example, most people who go to petting zoos, they don't become vegetarians. I don't know that this translates, and we don't have the data to substantiate that it translates to a stronger environmental ethic. But, you know, it depends, again, on, you know, who you talk to. We're seeing a wide diversity of perspectives on that.
All right. I don't know. Dr. Dudzinski, do you want to add anything at all to that?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the caller. And again, to tell people who are listening, maybe we have 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we're talking with Kathleen Dudzinski and Tony Frohoff. They're the co-authors of the book Dolphin Mysteries, Unlocking the Secrets of Communication. And it is published by the Yale University Press. As you talked earlier, I think both of the interest that you had in observing and studying these animals in the ocean is to, as I think one or the other of you said, essentially you'd like them not to pay any attention to you at all. that you're the idea is that you're there to observe, but your hope is that they would do whatever they would do, whether you were there or not, and you're just there to observe. And your interest is in seeing the way that they communicate with one another. There has been, I think, particularly maybe it was in the 60s and the early 1970s, some popular interest in the idea of communication, of dolphin communication. And there the idea seemed to be the possibility that there could be some cross-species communication, that somehow we would find some sort of a way that we could communicate with one another. Is that something that you think is... Maybe the question to start out with is that actually possible, or is that something that's just we would think that has an appeal for certain kinds of reasons, but the likelihood of being able to do that is pretty small.
Well, I think communication, as I mentioned earlier, already exists, and it happens cross species. Whether it's animals who are or communicating with their trainers or with swimmers in the wild or in captive programs. There is a variety of different ways for signals to be exchanged and communication to happen. The earlier work that you referenced was actually trying to see if dolphins would understand human language. And language and communication are not synonymous. They can be at times. Humans use language to share information, and it's one form of communication that we have. But whether dolphins will understand and be able to use something akin to human language to communicate with us, I would not believe that would happen. We do know that they understand the concepts of human language from work done by Lou Herman and his group in Hawaii, but we have no evidence that they actually use a form of language to share information.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that it would be possible for there to be communication. For example, I'm sure that there, as you could explain, there would be some kind of gesture, some kind of behavior that one dolphin would do with another that says, "I really like you." And you can imagine that I'm sure that dolphins and humans have bonded to the extent that a dolphin would say to that human in the way the dolphin has, "I really like you," and the human would understand what that means and would say it back, "I really like you too." And that certainly is communication, and it's a shared gesture. Everybody knows what that means. I guess I find myself thinking about that and wondering just how far that kind of communication can go.
Well, go ahead. I was just going to say, I think Kathleen, explained, some of the basic concepts really in a way I agree with. Wholly, and I think there's already communication occurring. And as to your question, David, I think it's a good one in terms of, I've ended up specializing to some degree in interspecies communication, and sometimes I unfortunately say interspecies miscommunication between dolphins and humans, because so often we presume that we know what they're saying or what their signals mean, and then we find that we were wrong, but often to the detriment of the dolphin. But there is definitely an aspect of communication that I've observed where people are understanding that we're coming to understand some of the signals that dolphins exhibit to one another, and they exhibit them to us. And sometimes after years of studying them, we're actually picking them up, whether they're acoustic, vocal signals or postural signals. And conversely, some dolphins and beluga whales, especially when they're solitary in the wild and they interact with people a lot or in captivity, they've come to understand a lot of our gestures and vocal signals. Just because I think the crux of it is, I am pursuing interspecies communication in the sense that I want to know not necessarily what a dolphin is thinking as much as what a dolphin is experiencing psychologically. Because I think it's important for us to understand more about their welfare so that we can improve the lives of individuals as well as populations. And so towards that end, I'm constantly looking at research such as that conducted by Kathleen and others, as well as conducting my own, to see how we can progress. And we write about that in the book, the progression of learning, how we can continue our interspecies communication with dolphins in a positive way.
I think also, when to add to that, when you think about specific signals that might mean something specific, you know, in terms of the gestures that we've identified or the behaviors that might mean, hey, hi, how are you, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Most of the signals that we've observed, most of the gestures or postures are don't have one specific meaning. To give you an example, if you think about when we wave our hands, we could be waving hello, we could be waving goodbye, we could be waving, you know, wait up for us, or trying to get someone's attention. It's similar when you look at how dolphins use their pectoral fins or their flippers to exchange contact with one another. Depending on where they touch on the body and when they touch and during what context and interaction will give a different meaning for that particular gesture or that signal. So when two dolphins come together after having been separated and they exchange flipper contact, so flipper to flipper, that's kind of a greeting, similar to greeting someone with a handshake. So the gestures, when you look at them for signals and what they might mean, you have to also realize that they're context dependent.
We have a couple of callers here. I'd like to try to get at least one in the time that remains, and that will be Pisodum, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Interesting conversation. I just wanted to have a comment on what you said of the experience people have with dolphins. You call it mystical. I'm not sure I go quite right that far, but it is special. I've made several trips to the Amazon in Brazil, and one of the tributaries, the Negro, there's a spot where you get in the river and with the guide and in a circle, and these pink dolphins will come right up between you and, you know, take food right out of your hand. And granted, they're being fed there quite a bit, so they like to do that. But it was really a very, of all the wonderful things we saw there, that sticks in my mind. And I think it's because as people who dwell on the land, we don't, to have something come up out of the water right close to you, just out of, from nothing. You can't see, the Negro means black, the river, you can't see 2 feet into the water, it's dark, and here he comes right up between you. That was really a special experience, and I just wanted to make that comment. Oh, they're pink, by the way. Why are they pink about 1,000 miles up the Amazon? Thank you.
Okay. Well, you can speak to that however you like. I don't know if you have an answer to the question why they're pink.
It's the adults that get, as far as I understand it, and talking from colleagues, it's the adults that become more pink, and it's a bit towards age.
Oh, okay.
And it's part of the species. And I also wanted to comment on, first of all, to thank the caller for sharing his experience and to say, yes, I mean, as a scientist, I certainly am not the one to call people's experiences with dolphins mystical. But as you alluded to, especially in the 60s and 70s, there began a whole, you know, in a sense, almost a subculture of people who attributed these experiences as one, as having a mystical quality. So it's just more my describing the sociological phenomenon. However, it doesn't have to be obviously mystical to be very special to people. And I think this caller presents something that really brings a good example of interspecies communication. There are human dolphin fishing cooperatives between wild dolphins and humans that have evolved. Have developed over decades. And this is without humans even intentionally feeding the fish. It's a wonderful example of interspecies communication.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. For people who want to read more on the subject, again, look for the book Dolphin Mysteries, Unlocking the Secrets of Communication, published by the Yale University Press, by our two guests, Dr. Kathleen Dudzinski. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Tony Furuhoff, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you both with us this morning. Programming here, by the way, on WILL, made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to hang around here. Up next, we have more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Her name, Peg Tyre. She is the author of The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do. She'll join us at 1:06. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat trading at 5.67, up 1.5. March 5.81, up 1. In Chicago, December wheat 5.33, down 3/4. March 5.52.5, down 1.5. December corn 3.81.5, down 4.25. March 3.98, down 5. May 4.09.5, down 5.25. July 4.21.5, down 4.5. January soybeans 9.